As we said in the last lecture, much of the Commedia involves Dante traveling through the afterlife, meeting up with a whole bunch of folks, many of whom, most of us, even those who are scholars, really don't know from their study of the past. And therefore, what we want to do today is to begin to help with the understanding of the peopling of Dante's afterlife. We want to set up the rules of the game to a great extent, and then begin to talk about especially the political background, because especially in Inferno, but really throughout the entire poem, Dante is going to be making political commentary through not only his own mouth and the mouth of Virgil and his other guides, but also through the mouths of so many of these folks whom he runs into.
One way of getting at this issue is to go to a question that I usually ask my students when we begin looking at Dante. The question is simply this: what do you need to get your membership card in Dante's afterlife? And I usually ask the question, and somebody puts up a hand and says, you need to be dead. And I say, that's the right answer. What's the second part? And usually somebody else says, you need to be dead by 1300, which is, of course, as we said in the last lecture, the actual date of the journey from the point of view of the pilgrim. Now, it's interesting if you think about this. First of all, it allows Dante the poet to have an enormous scope here in terms of who the pilgrim is going to encounter. Because what it means is that, well, this includes folks who died in 1299. It also includes Adam and Eve. Actually, Adam and Eve will show up as characters in the Paradiso. It also includes everybody in between. Now, notice that that means everybody. Dante does not distinguish between what we would think of as real people, historical characters who actually lived, and folks who come from books, characters in books. So that, for example, we get to see Aeneas. He's a character, even though he was a creation of Virgil, who also turns out to be a character there. So, dead by 1300, real or fictional. Now, the thing is that a lot of those folks are very famous. And a lot of those folks are famous in our time as well as in Dante's time. You've got people from the Bible who played a prominent role, and all kinds of political figures who have made a very big impact on world history. And all of those folks turn out to be people that we know something about, but maybe would like to know a little bit more. So commentaries are certainly necessary for them. But even more important, what we need to do is talk about the figures who are dead by 1300, who are folks who lived in Dante's Florence or in any of the neighboring cities, and whose fame really was a kind of local fame. In other words, folks who would have been pretty well known in Dante's time and place, but not well known at all, maybe not even known at all in our own time. So a good bit of what we're going to be doing now is to try and bridge that gap by talking about the scene that Dante grew up in.
Let's remember also that if Dante wants to talk about politics and other facets of Florentine life and Italian life around 1300, he by and large cannot use his own contemporaries directly to do that, because Dante is 35 years old in 1300, and therefore most of his colleagues and friends and contemporaries, his political buddies and his political enemies, are still alive. That to look at contemporary politics, Dante will sometimes indeed go way back into ancient history. We'll meet Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar and the Emperor Trajan, for example. But more often, he tends to go back, if you will, one generation, the generation of his parents and perhaps his grandparents. And there's a good reason for that. One is most of them are dead, and therefore they fit the rule. But the second thing is that these are the stories that Dante himself grew up with. Now, Ron and I were both born in the same year. We were born toward the end of World War II. So we don't remember World War II or another event in our parents' lives, the Depression. But boy, did we grow up hearing the stories about it. There are times when you sort of have to remember, you know, I only know this stuff because of other people telling me the story. I really wasn't around during the Depression. I wasn't really around and functioning during World War II. And that's what Dante is going to do. We're going to have an awful lot of folks populate Dante's afterlife that have died pretty recently, because not only are they people that are still remembered by Dante's audience, but he can use them and the stories he knows about them not only to talk about a little bit of recent history, but in many ways, symbolically anyway, to talk about the present, to talk about what's going on right here, right now. Different cast of characters, sometimes different labels on the political factions, but the basic problems have not changed very much since the generation before Dante and his contemporaries.
So we're going to start with that generation, and even though Dante himself will not limit himself to talking about Florence, Florence certainly is the center and certainly the focus. So before we talk about some people, we'll talk about where they lived. What kind of a place was Florence in the generation before Dante?
As we said in the last lecture, it was a busy, bustling, high population, high density city surrounded by walls. And that means life is lived largely outdoors. It means that people knew each other's faces, they knew each other's business, they knew lots of personal things about them. After all, housing didn't have lights and heat and a lot of other things. And even today, when one is in Italy, one finds that there are times a day when people just go out and stroll to be seen. So it was a life lived much more publicly, much less privately. And therefore, if we're going to talk about the politics of Dante's Florence, that's where we have to start. That is to say, if you ask the question, who doesn't like whom, there are a lot of ways to approach that. We can approach it, for example, as socially. That is to say, those who were parts of the old rural aristocracy had moved in don't like the nouveau riche. And that's a very important problem in Florence, for example. But a lot of times, the people you don't like, and this takes on political ramifications in Florence, are your neighbors, somebody who insulted you, somebody who insulted your sister, somebody who threw garbage around your house. And we know that a lot of the quarrels began with very personal things, and there's a very personal side to Florentine politics. The story that both Dante and contemporary chroniclers tell of the beginning of factionalism in Florence goes back to a guy who snubbed a woman he was supposed to marry when he got a better offer. And that perhaps is literally true. It happened in 1215. But much more important, it is symbolically true. And we never want to forget the sort of visceral, gut, local side of Florentine politics, and that will come out over and over and over when Dante meets Florentines, again, largely of the previous generation.
Remind ourselves that 1215 story. First of all, it turns out Dante uses it in the Commedia itself, but, you know, we think about, okay, person was snubbed, and so, well, let's not talk to them for a while. I was going to marry her, but they gave me a better offer. I'll marry the other one instead. Well, no, that's not how it ended. It ended with a lot of people, starting with the bridegroom, being killed. And an awful lot of straight-out, hardcore violence was the result of this. And that violence kind of continued. That if you look at 1215 as a starting point, it certainly had not diminished by the time that Dante sets the poem. And it certainly hadn't diminished in that generation immediately before the setting of the poem. So that we're talking about the existence of a lot of urban violence. People died in the streets. Okay, the stuff that you read about in Romeo and Juliet is sort of based on what was actually happening in the factionalistic struggles that were taking place in the cities of Italy.
Ron's exactly right. We need to think about a lot of violence, not always leading to death, but insults and all the rest that really did inflame people. And one of the reasons it got so testy and violent is because, needless to say, people, both those of the traditional aristocracy and the nouveau riche, wanted power. That's what you want. Political power. Be able to control the legal mechanisms, the judiciary, and other parts of the city as well. And, well, there are only so many offices to go around. And so, at least as one chronicler contemporary with Dante describes things, it was the competition for offices that made things so violent, so visceral, so constantly factional, that there were always these fights, because if these folks held office, then these folks didn't. And if these folks hold office, they can use that for their advantage to install themselves, ideally, in perpetuity in office. So there is a great deal of competition for power. Only so many titles, only so many jobs to go around. But this is only the beginning of understanding Florentine politics. As I said, there are also social distinctions. There are economic distinctions which don't always fit the social categories. You get, again, some very wealthy merchants who don't come from very important families. And, of course, they have money which they can use to gain power over the traditional nobility. And these kinds of tensions are also very clear. We'll see people from that aristocracy, for example, snub Dante, even when Dante's looking in on them, oh, let's say, somewhere in the middle of hell. They'll still sort of say, but you're not from a very important family. You're not from a family that can be traced back as many generations as my family can be traced back. It's more complicated than that, because in addition to what's going on inside the walls of Florence, Florence exists in a bigger world. For one thing, of course, Florence was an independent nation. Italy as a country only came along in the 19th century. And so Florence's independent neighbors, for example, are Arezzo and Siena and Pisa and Lucca and so forth. And these are independent countries too. And guess what? Independent countries fight. And they fight over many of the things that we would expect. They fight over, well, is that castle that's sort of in the border yours or mine? If we get this little piece, we have access to some more water that would flow into an area of our nation, and so on. And so there's a great deal of regional fighting over exactly the kinds of things you would expect, over border lines, over water rights, over access to highways, and all that sort of stuff.
Now, notice that we started locally. We've moved out a little bit to the neighboring city-states. We can move out even more and talk about causes for factionalism and political dispute in the larger circumstances of European politics as a whole. Because even as there were all of these independent city-states in the part of Italy that Dante is from, there were also larger, I'm not sure, world powers would be the best way of describing them, but at least larger European powers that also exhibited a lot of clout, not simply, let's say, in the case of the Holy Roman Emperor, one of those two powers, not simply in the territory where he had residence, but throughout Europe. And the other sort of political clout that was exercised in Europe as a whole and in Italy as a whole was with the Pope. So to start locally and move out, we now need to be a little bit more global in talking about the place of emperor and pope in the European political scene, and then sort of take it back locally and see how it affects Florence.
So Florence is a little nation in the whole European scheme, but a very important one because of its economic power and because of its geographical location. Well, there were, in the early Middle Ages, of course, the development of the papacy, the office of the Bishop of Rome, although it was much more a tradition than a government in the early Middle Ages. And there was the development of the Holy Roman Empire, beginning with Charlemagne in 800, rejuvenated by Otto the Great in the 10th century. But by and large, those officials and those powers were not in direct conflict. But beginning toward the end of the 11th century, they were in big-time conflict. And the ultimate question was, who rules the world? Pretty big question. That is to say, ultimately, when push comes to shove, obviously it's best if they work together, who really is first and foremost in charge? Who has the authority from God to rule in the world? And in the 13th century, the century in which Dante is born, that question took a particular political form that involves us thinking for a minute of a map of Italy. If you divide Italy as you go down the boot into three sections, it'll help. The top third, roughly, is a series of independent nations, of which Florence is one of the most important. The middle third, roughly, was controlled by the popes, not just as a spiritual center, but as their political territory. They had all the rights over the center part of Italy that any secular ruler had. And then the southern third was governed by a monarchy. It was a monarchy for a while of French, but it was a strong monarchy that included everything from, say, a little bit north of Naples, including the island of Sicily. So this is a political scheme. What happens around 1220 is this. The guy who's the monarch of southern Italy and Sicily also gets elected Holy Roman Emperor. And in theory, the Holy Roman Emperor is sort of the lord over these northern Italian city-states. Not much in practice, but in theory. But this emperor and king, Frederick II, Frederick Hohenstaufen is his name, has an idea. I'd like to really get control of those northern Italian city-states. I'd like that to be not just in spirit, but in fact, my territory, and I'm already king of the south. Okay, you can picture what this does. It means the Pope has the same neighbor on the north and on the south. And as it turns out, Frederick was not a very friendly neighbor, and a knockdown, drag-out struggle began between the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire for control of Italy, and in some real ways, control to be numero uno in Europe at this time.
A couple of comments to make about that. First of all, keep this in mind because Frederick himself becomes a player in the Commedia. He's somebody that we will see later on. But notice what this does to the story that we started out with, the story in Florence. You now have two competing world powers, two competing ideologies, and you have these smaller city-states, Florence, for our purposes, chief among them. When the factionalism in Florence develops, okay, one side fighting against another, there's a kind of natural tendency to go to the big guys on the outside and seek support. Well, the folks who wanted to seek the support from the emperor were called Ghibellines. The folks who wanted to seek the support from the Pope were called Guelphs. And all of a sudden, in Florence and in all of the city-states surrounding Florence, the struggles that were going on, sort of the umbrella term, struggle between Guelphs and Ghibellines, becomes a way of capturing something of what was going on, showing the linkage between what was going on in the city and what was going on in the larger theater of European and world politics.
So let's get specific for a second. Let's say you are part of a faction in Florence that's in the minority. What you will do then perhaps is go to one of those superpowers and say, hey, we'll be your guys in this territory. They really aren't interested in the ideology of Pope so much or the ideology of emperor. What they want is help. What they want to do is take over their own place. They want to be in charge. And since in Florence, the Ghibellines were traditionally the minority, they depended very heavily on sort of outsiders helping them out militarily and politically to try to get control of this place. And the time we're going to focus on is a time in 1260. Let me tell you how far this can go. Where the Ghibellines of Florence allied with the city of Siena, its southern neighbor, which was dominated by Ghibellines. And together they fought the army of Florence, which at that time was dominated by Guelphs, at a very famous battle named Montaperti in 1260. The Ghibellines won, and therefore the Ghibellines took over Florence, even though Florence had more Guelphs than Ghibellines. They took over temporarily. It was during that six-year rule of the Ghibellines that a fellow named Dante was born in Florence in 1265. And when Dante's 1 year old, the Ghibellines are kicked out, and his party, the Guelphs, come back into power. You see what I mean? These are the stories that Dante grows up with. These are the stories of the struggle for control over Florence. It's not about papal and imperial ideology primarily, although the propaganda is used to fuel the hostilities. It's about, to a much greater extent, local control, local power, local seizing and control over offices.
Now, you would think Ghibellines are out, Guelphs take over. Well, jeepers, maybe some of this factionalism will now stop. Turns out that the Ghibellines never really came back into Florence as a powerful force. So you have Florence as a Guelph city, and it remains a Guelph city, and it remains a happy, contented city. Well, not hardly.
Not quite, because, well, this has happened before, and it's happened since in politics. If basically one party comes to dominate, guess what happens? Squabbles break out within the party over the same old issues, insults, social standing, and all the rest. And so in the 1290s, Dante's an adult by this time, in the 1290s, we begin to get real new factions developing, not between Guelphs and Ghibellines. Ghibellines are minor players by now, at least in Florence. We get divisions within the Guelph party, and it gets very bitter in the way that former friends who become enemies become very bitter. We call these two factions of the Guelphs the whites and the blacks, simply by sort of colors that identified them, sort of armbands, if you will. And so Dante gets caught up in factional politics, the next generation. And the next generation is within the Guelphs rather than between the Guelphs and Ghibellines. And so, since the Holy Roman Emperor at this time is pretty weak in terms of Italy, each faction goes to the strongest political power in Italy and says, you back us. And the strongest political faction in Italy was the papacy. And by 1294, the papacy was headed by a fella, again, we'll hear a lot about him in Dante, named Pope Boniface VIII.
Well, what happens, of course, is that they're both looking for the support from Boniface, the whites and the blacks, but Boniface is only going to give the support to one. And as it turns out, for a variety of reasons, Boniface supports the black Guelphs rather than the white. He sends his troops to expel the whites, and it turns out that that is the direct cause of Dante's own exile. The circumstances are kind of interesting, and it's worth us saying a little bit more about it, because Boniface too is really a major player, a really important character in Inferno and mentioned throughout the whole Commedia. So a little bit more here might seem to be just a little bit more detail than you would want at this point. Trust us, it's going to be important as it goes on. A little bit more about Boniface and his relationship to the struggles in Florence is necessary.
It's first of all important to say that Boniface was himself a native of a town near Rome. He actually was a native of the Papal States. And becoming the Pope meant that he was involved in the governance of central Italy, the Papal States. And guess what? There are factions there too. Different families. And his family had been in and out of power as popes in the 13th century, and they had terrible, terrible and vicious enemies among other families with church offices in the Papal States. And so he's involved in a knockdown, drag-out struggle for political control over the area that he's supposed to be able to govern. At the same time, he's also in a knockdown, drag-out economic and political struggle with the French king. Because basically what the French king wants is more money from the church and more control of the church by his own office, and therefore taking away some power from the Pope. And so Boniface is involved in two major political struggles, one in central Italy and one, we would say, international. And what's important to see is Boniface, who was himself a canon lawyer by trade, and very old when he became pope, was almost totally consumed during his nine-year pontificate in these two separate, although occasionally they overlap, these two separate political campaigns, one largely of paper and propaganda, the other sometimes of swords and spears.
Now, we mentioned that all this is going to be necessary for us because the cast of characters, Boniface himself, Frederick the Holy Roman Emperor, a great many other people who were directly and indirectly involved in first the Guelph-Ghibelline struggle and then the white-black struggle, are going to be seen in the Commedia. But of course, in fact, the most important person that this struggle affects is Dante himself. Because once the Pope backs the black Guelphs, right, then Dante, a white Guelph, is doomed. That is to say, Boniface's decision to support the black Guelphs and send his troops to expel the whites was the direct cause of Dante's own exile. And as we mentioned at the beginning, Dante's exile is one of the most important things that we need to consider as a kind of condition for writing the poem, but also the issues of his exile, the issues of this whole struggle, this issue on a local level and this issue on a national level and this international level, all of this becomes part of the subject of the poem itself.
We need, therefore, to sort of stop for a second and say, just sort of flat out, that this is a poem of exile. It is unimaginable that Dante would have written something sort of just a little bit different had he remained sort of fat and comfortable in Florence for the rest of his life. It is permeated with the theme of exile, from Dante's statement at the very beginning about being lost in a dark wood of error through various characters he meets who, in fact, tell us different ways that they dealt with political rejection and exile, to some of the great theological issues he raises that are perhaps challenging to him because of his situation as an exile. At every level of reading this poem, it is a work of exile.
Yeah, there are a couple of ways to think about this to add to what Bill has said. First of all, it's highly unlikely that the poem would ever be written without the exile simply because it provides subject matter. Okay, but there's another way to look at it as well, because it seems that what happens is that in the early years of Dante's exile, what he was mostly concerned with was thinking about ways that he could possibly get back, okay, sort of making alliances and assuming that this was just a kind of a temporary situation, since there always had been this fluctuation that, okay, yeah, the blacks are in power now, but if we hang around for a while, we'll be able to get back. That didn't happen. All right? And it seems like at a certain point in the exile, Dante really turned his attention elsewhere. That is to say, instead of trying to figure out the best way of getting back from exile, he began to think about the larger meaning of exile. And to do this, it was not just simply sort of pondering the state of the universe in a vacuum. Dante, or so it seems, set about systematically to read and study and meditate and make himself essentially one of the most learned people ever to put pen to ink, or quill to ink, I guess, in his case.
We therefore need to see that what Dante is doing here is trying to come to grips on enormously different levels of reality with exile. Obviously, there's a way in which you come to it theologically. We are all, in a sense, exiles from the promised land of heaven. It becomes a metaphor for the human condition generally. But also, Dante sort of racks his brain to say, what is so unjust about the way we're governing ourselves, and what might we do about this? How can we untangle this maze to try to understand ways that we could live together well? Because Dante understood that the goal of human life was not earthly happiness, but that earthly happiness, A, was important, and B, was a pretty good condition for people, therefore, being able to seek those things that do last beyond the grave. If you're simply grubbing around to survive, and know that the way to survive is by stabbing literally or metaphorically somebody else in the back, you're probably not going to be focusing on those things that last forever.
So when he's reading and studying in his exile, obviously he reads a lot of works that are sort of classic works on politics, but also he goes to others who have either suffered from or written about exile themselves. And it turns out to be a pretty long list of poets, and it also turns out to be the case that he can go to sources like the Bible, And Bill started off by saying that exile really is ultimately kind of spiritual condition and has to do with all of us sort of separated from our home. That's the sort of stuff that Dante began to think about in a way that few others have. And so that when he begins to write the poem, he has not only the experience of exile, the meditation on it in his personal life, but also a huge number of texts at his disposal which deal with that central issue. When we start talking in the next lecture, we'll begin looking at those texts that Dante himself drew upon in his own Commedia.